Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rabbi Daniel Rosenthal. I'm associated with the Torah Academy of Sefer Tzaddi. My son, Rabbi Simcha Rosenthal, is the Hebrew Studies principal. Before introducing this evening's shiur giver, Rabbi Mann, Rabbi Reuven Mann, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to say thank you, Mevrosh, to Dr. and Mrs. Namutin for their hospitality and for graciously giving their house for this evening's shiur. And as some of you already know, they have provided refreshments for all to partake, and I guess people are taking now, we'll have later. Again, Toda Rabba. The shiur briefly is being made possible this evening and is sponsored as a community service activity of the Torah Academy of Suffolk County, by way of which I'm happy to note and to observe students, some of the students in the audience, and I see students already, young ladies with young men, terrific, you know, from Yerbo, and please God, give me a bias memo to Israel. For those of you who may not know, the Torah Academy of Suffolk County is the only Jewish all-day high school in Suffolk County. Seriously, that started in 1989 and has already graduated 9 senior classes. So it spans 11 years. And I think the Namutin have had kids throughout that period of time. The Academy is a modern Orthodox centrist school and espouses the principles of Torah, Mado, knowledge, culture, and Medina, the state of Israel, about which we will be hearing from Rabbi Mann in a moment. Just for those of you who may not know, this September, the Torah Academy will be opening the only modern Orthodox middle school in Suffolk County, with grades 7 and 8. I've been called back to run the Midday Kodesh program, and my co-associate, Mr. Gary Rugg, a retired public school administrator and a former middle school principal in Lindbrook, New York, has come on board to head the secular program. An informational meeting is being called for Wednesday, November 29th. If people have any interest in the lower school, the middle school, there's some material, and feel free to, you know, to pick. So that's November 29th at the Academy at 7:30 to learn more about this dynamic program. Having said this, I think that there is no one in the Jewish world that has not been affected by what has been going on in Eretz Israel, in Medina Israel. The fact of the matter is that when the Tfilah for the Medina and the Mishaberet Chatzal was recited, I think anybody, any Jewish person who hears it is absolutely gripped by it. And unfortunately, this is a situation which taxes, vexes, and perplexes all of us. And therefore, with a great deal of pleasure that we have an individual this evening who will shed some light on the subject. Rabbi Mann is they say in French, an alter father, an old friend of mine. He's a mukmach of Yeshiva University, founder of the mukmach of Rabbi Yochum Gurelik. Those of you who remember Rabbi Gurelik, famous Talmud Chacham, and Rav Mann has followed in his footsteps. Rav Mann is a Menahel since the inception of Yeshiva Nei Torah in Far Rockaway. He's the Rav of Rinat Yisrael, and also co-founder of an advanced women's post-high school program in Jewish studies in Inwood, New York. So without further ado, I'd like to call upon Rabbi Mann, who will be speaking to us this evening on the Middle East crisis, trying to make sense out of it from a Torah perspective. Rabbi Mann, Baruch Hashem.
Thank you very much. Trying is a very good word. This is not an easy task. And I just want to explain, it might be on your mind, why would anybody want to approach a political situation, which seems to be a historical political situation, from a Torah perspective. For example, if I was trying to understand a problem in American history or Civil War, Revolutionary War, you wouldn't talk about a Torah perspective necessarily on the Revolutionary War or any kind of problem that any country might be having. Basically, you try and understand, elucidate all the political factors, all the historical factors. So why is it different over here? On the surface, it would seem to be basically an issue of diplomacy, of statesmanship, of, you know, political considerations. And the underlying foundation, in my opinion, and I think anyone who follows the Torah, is that there is no way that you can possibly understand what is happening and certainly point in any kind of a direction towards any kind of a solution except through the Torah. Because this, what happens to Israel is different than what happens to all the nations. And I'm going to try and explain why that is so, to elucidate that to the best of my ability tonight. I just wanted to say something before I begin, because it occurred to me that, you know, to give this kind of a announce, you're giving a class the Torah perspective on a problem of this dimension, is not exactly, it doesn't sound like a very modest thing to do. So I'm always conscious, like, you know, who am I? This is something that a great rabbi, a great sage, should be doing. I didn't want it to give the impression of being presumptuous, like I'm the one that's going to tell you the Torah perspective. That's why it's a Torah perspective. Nevertheless, I feel that it's extremely important for those who have the ability to probe into the matter, and I feel I'm on solid ground. That is to say, I just want to make it clear, this is not like a halacha and you have to agree with me and this is Judaism. I'm giving you an exposition, and you'll see the sources that I'm basing myself on, and I'm pointing in a certain direction. It's certainly not, you know, the final answer, but I think it's a certain context in which you'll be able to make sense out of what's happening. And therefore, you see, in this kind of thing, it's very difficult to go into all of the details. I'm not going to do that. Like some books, you know, you can quote a pasuk and they'll try to apply it and they'll say, this is happening, this is the meaning of a certain prophecy. I'm not going to do anything like that. That's speculation. I'm going to try and show you the basic foundations. And insofar as we pretty much stick to the general principles that we can know for certainty, then I feel that I'm on solid ground. I'm not giving you my own opinion, and I'm not claiming to have any special insight, but I'm going to show you the basic sources and what they mean and how they affect the situation. Now, I said before that this situation cannot be understood from a purely political perspective, and everybody in the world has tried to solve it. The problem's been around for a long time, about 100 years or so, and all the greatest statesmen and the greatest geniuses have tried to understand it, and everybody's proposed, there's been more solutions proposed, every one of them has absolutely failed. And the truth of the matter is, it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So that itself would tell you that maybe somebody's missing something over here. And not that these people aren't intelligent, but if you don't have the proper framework to understand something, you're operating with false premises, then that's in my... That's the essence of what I'm going to try and show, that Israel today is operating with a completely false set of premises. So no matter how brilliant you are, and not to say that the policies that they're following today are necessarily brilliant, but even if they were brilliant, they could not succeed, because the entire premise is wrong. Now, I'm going to try and elucidate that. Let me just start off by showing you where I got this from. I didn't make this up myself, but the Rambam in the laws of fast. This is a biblical command that whenever a calamity befalls the Jewish people, the nation, so we have a certain obligation. And the obligation is, essentially, I'm not going to go through all of the particulars, to blow with the trumpets and to declare a fast day. I guess you would call it a national emergency. But the national emergency is not directed toward securing the physical means. It's rather to be engaged in a process of tshuva and introspection. And what does one thing have to do with the other? If there's a national calamity, so you're trying to address it. If it's a war, you get your army ready. If it's an earthquake, and you have other famine, you have other means of dealing with it. And the Rambam makes it very clear that the reason that you must do this is because whenever a national calamity occurs to the Jewish people, it's not based upon natural causes. You have to deal with the natural causes, because God operates through the natural causes, but the underlying cause is something outside. We'll use the term the metaphysical. And that's to say that it's basically the underlying cause is the fact that we deviated. If we want to call it sin, but we're not in line with the divine will. And the Rambam goes on to say that if you fail to do this, and if you seek to redress the problem by natural means, and you fail to become involved in this process, then the matter will get worse. If you'll say that this thing is, I'll quote the Hebrew, the min ha-olam, we'll say just a natural thing, and these things happen, you know, you could say that. Other nations face these kinds of problems, rebellions within their own country, insurrections, and so on and so forth. If you say that this is a natural thing, so then it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse because you're negating the divine message, and that's what's called Ba'alachem Imi Bekeri. You will go with me with chance. That is to say that you're going to say that your fate is basically like the fate of any other nation. You're basically operating under the natural law. So then God says he'll make it even worse. It'll become worse. And he says this approach, by the way, is auxiliarious, which means it's a certain kind of an arrogance to take this approach. When God is sending us a message and we refuse to listen to the message and we insist that it's purely natural, this is a form of arrogance, and because it enables people to continue with the false way of life, which is really the cause. So that's the foundation of foundation. From the Rambam it becomes clear that if a person maintains this position, that what is happening is just a natural thing, and that's my criticism of most of the Holocaust study that's going on today. I mean, there's a ton of research in all areas of the Holocaust, and I made a very controversial statement to my students recently. It may sound strange, but perhaps it will become clear as the evening goes on. I said the biggest Holocaust deniers are people like Elie Wiesel, in my opinion, is a Holocaust denier. And that sounds crazy because his whole life is dedicated to writing about the Holocaust. Yeah, because he's just tracking down the facts of the Holocaust. And he maintains that these facts occurred, but that's not the real story of the Holocaust. The story of the Holocaust is something which happened because of metaphysical causes that occurred to the Jewish people for reasons we may not know the underlying factors. So if you deny that, that's the real Holocaust. So in a sense, you too are a Holocaust denier. That flows from the statement. I know it may sound a little stark, and I could discuss it with you later if anybody has questions on this. But that's how strongly I feel about the underlying point. By the way, I'm not saying it to be critical of Elie Wiesel. I mean, he doesn't come to the situation from that perspective. He's looking at it as a historical phenomenon. That's why nobody really ever figured out the real story behind the Holocaust. Not to say that I could give you the answer either, because it's very, very complicated to, in a particular case, to try and elucidate what exactly was the problem, is the problem, whether it's too closely related to it, I believe. That's a separate, maybe we'll set up a separate shiur and we'll talk about that, okay? But for the time being, I just wanted to make this point and to apply it over here. Now, I want to explain to you why this is so. Why? What is the reason for this? Why do we say that whatever occurs to the Jewish people must be understood on two levels? On the practical level, you can't ignore nature, the natural reality, and on a metaphysical level. Now, this can be explained through certain psukim. For example, it has to do with creation. We read the parsha of Ha'azinu, and Moshe sets forth the future of the Jewish people, what will happen if they're obedient, what will happen if they're disobedient. But there's an interesting thing over here. It starts off when Moshe is about to sing the song, and he says that the heavens, let the heavens listen and I'll speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. So Rashi says he's sort of calling heaven and earth to be witnesses, which is a strange kind of an idea. In what sense are heaven and earth witnesses? So Rashi explains that he meant to say that they're permanent. I'm flesh and blood, and I'm not going to be here forever, but I want this to be here forever, this message. So I'm calling to witness the heaven and earth, because they are permanent. They're permanent. What's the idea behind it? There's an important idea behind this, which has to do with certain fundamentals. A person doesn't have any real concern is that he's going to wake up tomorrow morning and the sun is not going to be there. The heaven is not going to be there. I don't think that anybody is worried about that. You have a certain sense of permanence. You're not afraid that the world is going to cease to exist. I don't think a person goes on vacation, he plans a beautiful vacation to Bermuda, and he's trembling because he wants to sit in the sun and he wants to go snorkeling, and he's worried that maybe when I get there won't be a sun anymore. Maybe there won't be an ocean anymore. Maybe everything's just going to go away. Well, why not? Why aren't you concerned about that? So you have a certain sense. You have a certain sense that there's a permanence. Now, what's the reason for that? Where does that come from? How do you know? I mean, just because it's been here until now, maybe you'll wake up tomorrow morning and everything will be gone. Obviously, you couldn't live that way. But the reason why it doesn't make sense is because if you understand the nature of reality, why are things the way they are? And that's what we read this past week in the Bereshit, that everything exists because God created. That is to say that the world in which we find ourselves has no self-sustaining reason for existence. And the only true existence is the Creator, who basically is beyond the physical, cannot be compared to anything within the physical, is a being of infinite power and knowledge and greatness. And for some reason which we really can't even discern, it's His will, He willed it, that the world should come into existence. That's the concept of creation from nothing. Yesh me'ayin is the expression in Hebrew. Which means to say, and the Rambam elucidates fundamentals of our faith, and that is the foundation of knowledge, is to know that there is a first existence. And he has brought everything else into existence. And everything else that exists in the heavens and the earth exists only because of the truth of his existence. Now listen to what he says. He says, if you could imagine that God did not exist, then nothing else would be able to exist. Because the source of everything that exists is the existence of God, the truth of His existence. And it's His will that brings the world into existence. However, if you could imagine that everything else would cease to exist, that everything which God created would cease to exist, then He alone would remain in existence. Because He would not be diminished if everything else were to be nullified. Because everything that exists requires Him. But He, blessed be He, does not require them or any one of them. Therefore, the truth of God's existence is different than the truth of our existence. If a person just understood this lesson and internalized it and would grasp the significance of it, then the shiur itself would be worthwhile, this particular point. The person has to know, why do we exist? Why does the world exist? What is the source of its existence? We have no real claim to existence. We have no real basis for existence. The only reason why we exist is because there's a Creator. And in His infinite will or wisdom, which we cannot discern, He decided to create this world. But this world exists only as long as His will relates to the world. That's an important point. And that is to say that, in a sense, this is this week's Sedra. The world doesn't have to exist. The world exists for a purpose. God brought it into existence for a certain purpose, for mankind to live a certain kind of a life. That was His will. So if mankind should reach a stage, should become so degraded and corrupt that it would no longer be in line with the will of God, then what would happen? It would cease to exist. Well, where do we read about that in the Torah? Did this ever happen? That's the story of Noah. That's the story of the flood. That is the story of the flood. And that's the point. For Noah Matzachim, but Noah found favor. Okay, I'm not going to get into the issue that subsequent to that God made a promise never to destroy the world again. That's a different shiur. That's Wednesday night. We'll be doing that maybe next week. But the point that you have to understand is that, so therefore you need that worry, well, now that you have the promise. Other than that, the world is in a pretty corrupt state. You might have to worry. But we do have the promise that God said He'll never again bring a flood to destroy the world. So if that's the case, you can relax that the world will not cease to exist. Why won't the world cease to exist? because the reason that it exists is because of God's will. And God has told us that whatever the problems will be in the future, he'll deal with them in a different way, but he will not destroy the world itself. Okay. So if you understand that, if you accept that, it makes sense. So now what I want to say is, what about the Jewish people? Is there any reason to fear for the destruction of the Jewish people? Is such a thing possible? Do people stay up at night? Well, we're worried about the crisis, of course, and this is troubling everybody, myself as well. But when you think about it, I mean, you know, there's anxiety, but when you think about it, do you ever think in these kinds of terms that it is conceivable that there would not be, I mean, heaven forbid, but I mean, we're just talking now. Is it possible that the Jewish people could cease to exist? And that's, I think it's a very important point, which I'm going to address tonight. I'm going to address that. Okay, let me hear it. I like a little bit of interaction.
It says in Ha'azinu that we're going to continue to exist.
So therefore you're saying that it's an impossibility.
Well, if the Torah is true, then it's an impossibility.
Okay, so then what are we worried about? Then we have nothing to fear.
Well, we're worried about ourselves as individuals. We're not worried about each other.
Okay, but we are worried about Israel, and that we're in America.
We're worried about Israel. We're worried about the individuals who live there. We don't know that this is the Biyat HaMashiach. We don't know that, really.
Right. The point, I agree with you. The reason why I gave the introduction about the existence of the world is because of the analogy that I want to make. And that is, just like the world exists only because it's a special creation of God, so too the Jewish nation is different than any other nation in the world. Every other nation in the world exists because of natural causes. And once God set the world into motion and peoples gathered together, whatever the factors are, it could be common land, could be common language, could be wars, whatever the situation is, France, Germany, Hungary, whatever nation or in past empires, I don't believe that God intervened and created them because he wanted them to exist. That's part of the natural course of events. That's why, I don't know if you read this essay by Mark Twain, and he mentions that all the he has a question. He can't understand the Jews. How could the Jews have managed to survive when all of they've been subject to persecution and destruction attempts? All the great empires of the world have sought to destroy them, and they're all gone from the scene, and yet the Jew persists. And he talks about the Jew, how they managed to not just persist, but how they managed to succeed and thrive. And he ends it off with the question, what is the secret of the Jews? The Jewish people is different. According to the Torah, it makes it clear, this is the theme of the entire Torah, Hayom Hazeh Nieyeis Olam, this day you have become a nation. That is to say that the Jewish people is different in that we did not become a nation through any kind of natural causes, but we are a special creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Jewish people is a special creation of God. We say it in the Haggadah, that had God not redeemed us from Egypt, then we and our children's children would have still been slaves in Egypt. And this idea is expressed, the covenant, and you shall be, the negotiations between Moshe and the Jewish people. Once the Jewish people agreed, so they entered into the covenant, and then they became a special, unique people, which exists in the same way that the world exists, only because of the will of God. That's extremely important. If you're Jewish, you have to know this. You got to know what the underlying why you exist. And once you understand why you exist, you have to understand what the purpose was. Just like if you care about the world, you're an environmentalist, you care about the world, so then you have to know why the world exists and what the purpose is. So if you're a humanitarian, you direct yourself towards helping mankind fulfill its purpose, because that's the only way it can thrive, it can succeed. If you're a Jew, if you care about the Jewish people, you have to know why the Jewish people exist and what the purpose is, and you want to help Jews, you got to sort of direct them towards the purpose. Otherwise, you can't. If you don't know that, how can you help Jews? No matter how well-meaning you may be. There's many statements. One of my favorites is the one in Yeshaya. Amzu Yotzarti Li. God says, this nation, Yetzira, I have fashioned unto me, And they shall declare my praises. So it's telling you quite openly that the nation exists. There's no basis, by the way, for any feelings of nationalism, of pride, of greatness, that we're a heroic kind of a people, because we don't exist because of anything that we did. We didn't bring ourselves into existence. God brought us into existence, and God makes it very clear, by the way, that it's not because of your merits. And he criticized them. Devarim, he criticized the Jews, that you're a stiff-necked people. He speaks very harshly. He said it's really only because of the fathers. That's why the idea that the identity of the Jewish people is the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is exceedingly, exceedingly important. And that's what gives Hebron its a tremendous importance. That's the whole idea of why there was a Ma'aras HaMachpelah. That Vayivcha Bezarim, that God chose the children. So we exist because God has chosen us. And there's a purpose. There's a purpose. And the purpose is that Tehilos HaYisateru, that we should become a special kind of a nation. Of course, I can't go into all of the particulars. That's study of Torah, to keep the mitzvot. And it's not just enough to keep the mitzvot in a perfunctory kind of a way. It's to understand the deep wisdom of the mitzvot and to perfect yourself in accordance with that for yourself and for all of mankind. As it's pointed out, this is not stressed enough, that we should behave and perform the mitzvot in a way that the entire world will recognize the tremendous wisdom, and they will say, Rakam Chacham Vanav, Anagayagad Lazah. But what a wise and discerning nation is this great people. We're supposed to be a great people that the entire world will emulate. Why do we care about the emulation of the world or the admiration? Because God cares about the world. And we are the instrument through which the purpose of mankind will be fulfilled. Because eventually the entire world will come to recognize the truth of the existence of God, and they'll renounce idolatry, and they will live the correct lifestyle. Doesn't mean that they'll convert to Judaism, by the way. We had a speaker last week in Noachai. Does not mean, there's nothing indicating that the rest of the world does not have to convert to Judaism. For them, it's sufficient to keep the basic values, the philosophy of Torah, and the seven Noachide laws. So I just want to tell you, I mean, there's good news and there's bad news if you understand the basic premises. And that is to say that we really, in a sense, don't have to worry about, we don't have to do that much. We don't have to worry about the external enemies that confront us. We will always be a minority. I mean, I'm not talking until the Messianic era. That's a different issue. Whatever I'm saying is until the Mashiach comes. But we will always be weaker because you are the fewest of all the nations. From a purely physical standpoint, there's no way, shape, or form that the Jew can exist. I mean, you don't have to be a believer for that. And you just study history and you see all the persecutions. You see the weakness of the Jew. How did we ever make it through thousands of years of exile and destruction, not to mention Holocaust? I mean, it's just an impossibility. And God is saying that you won't make it. You will not make it on your own strength. And if you take that attitude, because sometimes you'll be successful. You'll be successful because I'm there protecting you and I'm driving your enemies away in front of you. But very often, you know, that's how the ego works, that a person always wants to take the credit for himself. And that's what God warned us about in the Devarim. You'll say, Kochi v'yotam yodi. And that's the absurdity. Everybody has that, you know. That's the way it is. People are born into a big business and so on and so forth, and then they take it wasn't their doing, they were just fortunate. But they like to take the credit for the accomplishment. But the only, what God is telling you is like this, and we learn this in, if you go out against your enemies, you see an enemy which is far mightier than you. So there's a command not to be afraid of them. And this becomes a biblical prohibition, that the Jewish soldier is prohibited from engaging, allowing himself to get distracted and to fall into any kind of a fear, a pachad, a hysteria. Why? It's saying you'll encounter a mighty army that from the ordinary standpoint, we're supposed to live according to the natural law, is far superior to us. So why shouldn't we be afraid? Ki ad Hashem Elokecha imach. Because the Lord your God is with you. Hamotziach me'eretz Yisrael. That is to say, that in reality, anybody else, I would advise to be afraid. Because you're in a situation of danger, and fear would be the appropriate response. We're not supposed to be stupid. If you're in a situation, you happen to find yourself in a bad neighborhood, and it's a bad time of the night, and there's no police around, so fear is pretty appropriate. It's realistic. So for any other nation in that situation, yeah, fear would be appropriate. But you have another factor working for you, and that is your special relationship to God, and God's promise that He will protect you. Now, if you need a little proof of that, we'll take a look at your entire history. That's the entire history. How'd you get out of Egypt in the first place? The mightiest empire in the world at the time. No nation had ever succeeded in rebelling against them. And how'd you make it through the wilderness for 40 years? And your garments did not deteriorate, and you provided with clothing, and it was scorpions and snakes and so forth, and then all the enemies that arose against you. Not to mention continuously throughout history. That's because God protected you. By the way, that was the sin of the spies. And that's why they didn't have the merit to enter into the land, because they got caught up in the practicality and the physicality of it, and they denied the metaphysical character. They denied this element. So what I'm telling you is that the Jewish people always live under the providence. I'm talking about the people as a whole now. Now, in terms of an individual Jew, that's a different issue. The doctrine of the Rambam and most of the great Rishonim was that as far as an individual is concerned, you can't always say that this happened to you because God wanted it. If a person trips, falls down the steps, something happens, he immediately thinks, well, what did I do to deserve it? For an individual, it could be providence. Sometimes it's providence. It could be wrong place, wrong time. That depends on the level of the individual, and it's a complicated issue. However, for the Jewish people, for the Tzibur, it's always under the Ashkacha. And the Ashkacha can relate to the Jewish Tzibur in two ways, and I'm going to basically simplify it for our purposes tonight. If the Jewish people is fulfilling their task, if they are the kingdom of priests and the holy nation, they're living in accordance with the will of God, then they will be absolutely... Of course, this means you can't negate. God demands that we operate in the natural framework. As it says by David, by David called the Ruch of Maski of Hashem Imo, that David used Seichel in every one of his endeavors. The Torah never excuses us from the obligation to use Seichel. That is to say, in designing an economy, an army, we must use our seichel. That's as we'll soon see, that's with Yaakov. You can't negate the laws of nature and just sit back and pray for miracles. Ain't some chalanes. So part of our perfection is that we undertake upon ourselves, we accept the basic responsibilities to function in accordance with the laws of nature and do everything that's necessary, while recognizing that all of our efforts, no matter how intelligent they are, will not succeed unless they have the fruition will come from the support of God. To the extent that when we are operating on the highest possible level, the Torah promises that not one person will be harmed. And that's what the Ramban says on the Parsha. When you go out to war against your enemy, and you warrant the divine protection because you're living in accordance with God's will, not only will you be successful, but not one person will be harmed. He says that's why if you read Tanakh, When Joshua, Yeshua, there was a setback. In the second war, they fought against Ai, and 36 men were killed in the battle. So he started to declare a whole fast, and he prayed out to God, how could this happen? And Ramban says, well, that's not a high number. In war, 30, all life is precious, right? We know that. But 36, relatively speaking, is not a huge number. He says, no, because what brought Yeshua was that there must be sin. Because if there wasn't sin, not one person would be killed. So the way the Torah depicts it, our relationship to God, it's a beautiful analogy. And it's really in the Birkas Kohanim. We call it the Duchening. It's God's face will shine upon you. That's when God relates to us in a positive way. It's Ha'aras Panim. He shines. Of course, God is not physical, so one doesn't envision that. We're just going to try and understand it in our context. It's as though you have this great benefactor who has the power to do anything that you need, to provide you with any possible need, so you want to get a smile from him. You want him to shine his countenance upon you. That's the bracha of Birkas Kohanim. But nothing mystical, nothing magical. And the bracha is only important, it's only meaningful insofar as people hear the bracha and they understand the idea of the bracha. That Yar Hashem Panavei Lecha, where God causes his countenance to shine upon you and then he gives you peace. That means to say that you're fully in line with the will of God. And when you're fully aligned with the will of God, that's when you have Eretz Yisrael. Because God gave you in order to establish a certain type of a society, which would be living, and it's vital to have this society. Because it's an impossibility to fulfill the Torah properly on the highest level in Chutz La'aretz. It is an impossibility. Because no matter how sincere you are, you're going to be affected by the values of the society that you're in, which are totally contrary. Totally contrary to the real values of Torah. We try our best. We try our best. That's our situation now. And we're modern and we're Orthodox. We're keeping the Torah. But it's an impossibility to reach the highest level because the culture permeates everybody. And I can show you how it affects religious outlook. So that's the ultimate idea, that God has given us a land. But we're not in that land right now. So what's wrong with the world? The world is not functioning the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be in the land of Israel. We're supposed to be establishing a certain kind of a society, and mankind is supposed to be learning from us. So you can understand why we have tzaras, because none of these things are happening right now. There's nobody that's looking at the Jews and saying, what a wise and discerning people is this great nation. Nobody is saying. So that's a problem. Now, on the other hand, if we deviate from the will of God, and if we seek to give up our identity, we seek to fashion a different Jewish identity, which is not rooted in Torah, in the purpose that God created us for, so then something else will happen. Let me just, I think it's best sometimes to just read the words. That is, that's called a breaking of the covenant. And it says that God said to Moshe that, well, I know that when you die, this nation will arise and they'll go lusting after foreign gods. That they will be, that they'll come there in their midst. Again, it's an effect of assimilation. And they'll abandon me and they will destroy my covenant that I made with them. And listen carefully. He says, my anger will be kindled against them and I will abandon them and I will turn my face away from them. And the famous expression in Hebrew is hester panim. That doesn't mean to say I'm going to throw any punishments at them. I'm simply going to turn my face away from them. And when I turn my face away from them, then great, great and terrible evils will befall them. And they will say in that day, it's because there's no God amongst us that these evils have befallen us. That is what's referred to in the philosophical literature as a period of hester panim. Which means to say that the only reason you aren't experiencing these evils is because God was out there driving away your enemies, unbeknownst to you, unseen by you, God was driving them away. When he turns his face from you, then you are in very big trouble. You know why you're in big trouble? You know why the Jews are in big trouble? Because, you know, if you watch these nature shows, so there's different kinds of animals, and there are some animals that don't really have natural enemies, I guess, like an alligator or a crocodile. Or a lion. I think a lion. Right, lions don't have any real natural enemies. But then, of course, there are other animals that are very vulnerable because they have natural enemies. You know, the same thing is true about people. The Jew. What would you say? Give me a good example about this of an animal which has a lot of natural enemies. They always have to be afraid, you know, because the predators are after them. Antelopes. You see, it's not good to be an antelope without protection. Okay, if you're going to be an antelope, stay together with the pack.
I think that was the basis of the mutual
of Omaha. You had to have
protection.
Okay, well, this is our mutual. We too. See, I would say that the Jews are a very endangered species. The Jews have nothing but natural enemies because the entire world is out to destroy the Jews. And that's a complicated subject, why it's the case. I can quote to you. This is, I suggest everybody should read it. Get a copy of the Rambam's. It's the Igeres Taimon, the epistle, the letter to Taimon, to Yemen. And he says that God has made us unique by his laws and precepts. And our preeminence is manifested in his rules and statutes. And as scripture says, in narrating God's mercies to us. And what great nation is there that has statutes and ordinances so righteous as this law, which I set before you this day? Listen carefully. Therefore, all the nations instigated by envy and impiety rose up against us, and all the kings of the earth motivated by injustice and enmity applied themselves to persecute us. They wanted to thwart God. By the way, that's a basic principle. It's very important to understand the nature of the hatred that the Arabs are manifesting. It's really a hatred against God. It's stated by David in Tehillim, Lama Rachuam, why do the nations, why are they agitated? Al Hashem, the Al Mashicho, against God and His Anointed One. So really, this is, we're getting into the whole idea of Amalek. It's really a hatred against the true God. You will say, well, they're religious people. I know they're religious, but they're worshipping a different God. And because of that, they have an enmity against the true God and His chosen people. It's the fact that we're Jews, in the mind of the world, it doesn't matter, it's worse if you assimilate, because the world looks at you as a Jew, and if you understand the psychological factors, as the rabbis say, it's a law of nature. Esav hates Yaakov. There are deep psychological reasons why that hatred is always going to be there. Whether it will manifest itself and spill over into anti-Semitism or not depends upon other factors. A lot of it has to do with the behavior of the Jew. Ironically, when the Jew tries to assimilate, he makes it worse for himself. When he keeps the Torah with confidence and true belief, he makes it better for himself. But he says that ever since the time of the revelation, every despot or slave that has attained power, be he violent or ignoble, has made it his first aim and his final purpose to destroy our Torah and to vitiate our religion by means of the sword, by violence or brute force, such as Amalek, Sisera, Sancheriv, Nebuchadnezzar, Titus, Hadrian, etc., etc. And you can add in the rest of the names. Now, when God turns His face away from us, then it doesn't necessarily mean that He's punishing us. It just means that the natural forces will take over. You're going to face the consequences of being a Jew in a very dangerous environment, which is, by its nature, it's hostile to Jews. That's not to say, I mean, there are cases where it's more than just that. I don't think a case like the Holocaust is simply has to punish. Because that's just out of the ordinary, and that seems to be something which has a specific design and a specific purpose. But what the Torah is saying is you don't really need to account for much of the suffering of the Jews, other than the fact that this has to put them. However, this is extremely important. This is extremely important that even when God can relate to us in two frameworks, either in the framework of shining His countenance, or in the framework of covering His face from us, has to put them. But even in has to put them, there's a providence that relates to us. The providence of Hester Punim that relates to us is that He won't let us be destroyed. It's like sometimes a father is estranged from his son because they've had too many problems and quarrels, and the father just thrown him out of the house. And he's off on his own, and he has to make his own way. But unbeknownst to him, the father can't tolerate the idea that his son will starve to death, will be destroyed. So he finds ways to provide him with enough, but just to get by. Not just to get by. He's not going to bring him back into the house. He's not going to give him his inheritance. If the kid were to make up with the father, he could have a fantastic life. But whatever, that's a quarrel. So, you see, he's turned away his face. As far as the kid knows, it's like he doesn't have a father. But he does have a father because it manifests itself in his... But that he will not allow his son to be destroyed. That I can't do. And that's what God is saying over here. That we... I'll quote to you from the Rambam, and then I'll go into the practicalities of the situation. We are in possession of divine assurance that Israel is indestructible and imperishable and will always continue to be a preeminent community. As it is impossible for God to cease to exist, so is Israel's destruction and disappearance from the world unthinkable. As we read, quote, "For I, the Lord, change not, and ye, O sons of Jacob, will not be consumed." Similarly, He has avowed and assured us that it is unimaginable that He will reject us entirely, even if we disobey Him and disregard His behest. As the prophet Jeremiah says, "Thus saith the Lord, if heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, then will I also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord." That is to say, just like that can't be measured, so too it's an impossibility that God has made an eternal commitment and a covenant with the Jewish people that they can never, ever be destroyed. Now, this is the foundation. As far as the dealing with the crisis that occurs and applying it to the particular case, because of these reasons, the classical response of the great Jewish leaders to any crisis has always been on a twofold level. That is to say, they always address the practical, as the case of Yaakov Avinu. He prepared for diplomacy, prepared for war, and he prayed to God. Other case that comes to mind, the case of Esther. When Mordechai presented her, did she have the responsibility to come up with the plan of action? What did she say first when she finally did agree to accept? The tumor will lie. First we have to do tshuva. First we have to address the underlying cause. Because the real cause for why this is happening is because we're not living in line with our true reality. We've deviated from the course of Torah. We're not living as the Jewish people ought to live. So we're not going to have the countenance of God shining upon us. So whatever we do is going to fail. But once you do that, then you have the obligation to act in the most intelligent manner. You can't go to either extreme. You can't just get lost in some kind of a religious frenzy. On the other hand, you can't be like today, many in Israel that say, Kochi v'yotzem yadi. It's just a matter of power politics. So, if that's the case, let me see if I can give you some thoughts, some of my thoughts as to how all this fits in and impacts upon the current crisis. My opinion, I'm based on what I'm saying over here, and this may be a depressing thought, I maintain that it is impossible that anything that Israel is doing, any kind of a peace initiative, any peace plan, any peace process can solve the problem and to bring any kind of a lasting peace. That I believe is an impossibility because of what I've said to you. The covenant of the blessings and the curses, which means to say that the fate of Israel will never be determined purely by practical means. It can only be, that is, even if they had the greatest chacham, the greatest wise men, the greatest statesmen, the greatest weapons, it all would not succeed because it's not going to be in line with the metaphysical cause, with the metaphysical reality of God. And if you believe in the Torah, That follows automatically. This is not speculation. It's not any discovery that I've made. Now, if that's the case, the way Israel's existence today, the way it's structured, the way it's founded, is not, in my opinion, designed for this kind of a success. Can't succeed. Because, essentially, it's not really founded to be what the Torah envisions. The Torah, this is not has not been founded to fulfill, to accept the fact that it's a Jewish state, to accept the fact that we exist because of a covenant, and that our objective is to the best of our ability, and God judges us by our effort. But it's not even the goal. So if that's the case, since the objective is really to in a real sense, if you want to be honest, to really break Jewish identity, or to recast Jewish identity, to create a new kind of a Jewish identity, which is based upon nationalism. And the Torah is relegated to a certain kind of a place in the society. That's if it's, you know, among others, they want to remove the Torah element completely. If that's the case, what they really want to do, and what they've succeeded to a large extent, is to create a new definition of Judaism, or of the Jewish people. It's a new identity. It's a nationalistic phenomenon with a certain type of a culture, and it's modern, and it's democratic, and it's technological. And so they're trying to recreate. And it really means to abandon the covenant. That's the abandonment of the covenant. We're not the classical Jewish people. See, that's why I maintain that the foundations aren't correct. And if the foundations aren't correct, then how can you possibly succeed? Well, you could succeed if you maintain that it's only a matter of practical power, of physical power. But that's not the case. Because in terms of physical, it's not physical power, you're a different kind of a nation. I mean, unless you just deny the Jewish people, then you deny Torah, then you deny God. But all these things are interconnected. Now, let's just review what took place with Israel, because Israel has been pretty successful. Up until 1967, it was very successful. Israel was able to defend herself against her enemies, starting in 1947, And then in 56, because the nation, the army kept getting better and more powerful. But and then the tremendous victory of 67. I don't know if, looks like kind of a young crowd. I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember the excitement of the Six-Day War. The tenseness, the period of tenseness, maybe Rabbi Rosenthal. But I don't know anybody else. It looks like a younger, yes? You remember that? Yeah. Yeah, you remember the tremendous emotion, the euphoria.
I was in the United States on
it. Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Where's the mic? Okay. I'm warm here. No. But I read the books with such intensity. It's like, you know. Can somebody... Yeah, I was a kid at the time, but I was very precocious, you know, so I was... Now, I remember the emotion of before, because nobody knew beforehand. I mean, everybody was expecting some tremendous calamity, because the Arabs had said that they're going to... It was another Holocaust. If you remember that. They had proclaimed... Nasser said that they were going to throw you into the sea. I mean, then they were, the Arabs were pretty honest about their intentions.
There were pictures of... people digging graves. I mean, Yeshiva Brockman digging graves in Tel Aviv, yeah. And Levi Eshkol gets onto the radio, supposedly to buck up the people, and basically falls apart on national radio, and everybody just sees that this is basically we're at the end.
Yep. Yeah, there was that mood. There's no question about it. There was that mood of despair. And but nevertheless, Israel achieved a tremendous victory. But to me, that expression, that victory was not an expression of true Jewish strength, if you understand what I mean. Because there's a classical weakness that Israel has. That was, but the strength that Israel had in those days derived from two sources. It was after the Holocaust. So all the Jews were permeated with the sense of tragedy and that never again. So the will to fight and to defend the Jewish people, no matter what the concept of the Jewish people is at the time, was very, very powerful. And also there was a tremendous element of sympathy from the nations. Tremendous element, because the world at that time, after the Holocaust, they discovered what had taken place, and there was a certain amount of guilt. There was a collective guilt among the nations, which didn't last very long, but at that particular time, it didn't. It didn't live. As long as Israel was perceived as the weakling, so there was a certain amount of guilt, and there was a rooting, because the whole world was rooting for Israel at the time, not except for the communist world and the Arab world. Yeah, the French, and they turned their back at that particular time. So the Allies started, but that, whatever, miraculously, they wound up with an alliance with America, which I think is very, very significant. Because it proves to you that even with an alliance with America, it's not enough. It's just not enough to save Israel. But then... You see, I maintain this wasn't true strength. And it created a certain dangerous mentality, a certain overconfidence, which led to the surprise of the Yom Kippur. You know that. You know, because there was a tremendous delusion, which affects them right now. The overestimation of the self. And the belief that they were so superior that the Arabs would not dare to attack them. That belief was so powerful that they were willing to even take tremendous risks, and even the idea was that even to absorb a first blow from the Arabs, because they were invincible, and in no time they could turn the tide. That brought them to the brink. Things were very, very, very close. More on the Golan Heights, if you understand what the plan was. The main attack was not going to be from the Sinai. That was more of a diversion, and the main attack, and they reached a point where they could have broken through at certain points of the Golan and cut Israel in half. That's why Dayan's decision was to throw the entire Air Force to the Golan front and secure that first, because the Sinai, they had land to protect them. Just if you need a reminder that the Golan is really important. In this era of missiles and nuclear weapons, it's very important. Now, what happened was, Dayan, what was Dayan's reaction? For those who, you don't have to have been there, by the way, you can read some history books. Dayan's famous statement afterward, do you remember? He's waiting for a phone call. I'm waiting for a phone call. Who is he waiting for a phone call from? From King Hussein. He's waiting for a phone call. Because we assume now that we've established the fact that we can't be defeated, so now you're going to come and finally accept us and make peace with us. And the idea was that we would, basically make a deal, give back land, whatever the configuration, how much land, don't know. But he was convinced that he was going to get a phone call from King Hussein. Dayan was not a stupid individual. I don't mean to disparage anybody over here. These are very intelligent people. In response to that, the Arabs then had their big meeting, the Arab League meeting at Khartoum, and they came out with the famous three no's. No recognition,
no negotiations, and no peace. That was the answer to the waiting for a phone call. I mean, you see that the Israelis could never get it right. They always had to believe that deep down, eventually they're going to accept us and we're going to live side by side with them. That's the underlying conviction of, and they have to. They have to believe that. And they can't get rid of that belief to this very day. You see, for the Arabs are doing Israel a tremendous favor. They were really helping Israel, because the more they said no peace, the more they said no negotiation, the more they said that we're going to liquidate the Zionist entity, the more it was good for Israel, because there was no pressure on Israel. The world was able to understand why Israel has to fight back. And Israel is the one to have to fight back. Because Israel needs the approval of the world. They can't stand alone. Psychologically, they can't stand alone. Because they're not rooted in Torah. So if you don't have Torah, so then you're going to live it according to the world's principles of democracy and self-determination of peoples, and not to be an occupation power, and so on and so forth. That's what they live by. So you see, then the Arabs changed their tactics. Then the Arabs got smart. They changed their tactics, and they learned that that's not the way. That they began to adopt the rhetoric, and they became brilliant at it. If you listen to some things in the academies, the rhetoric of the West. They got educated in the lingo, in the ideals of Western and democracy, and we're a struggling people, and we're fighting for liberation and national rights, and so on and so forth. And suddenly, the whole tide of public opinion began to shift against Israel. Israel was terribly inept. They couldn't defend. If you watch, even today, you're watching Israeli trying to debate some of these very polished Palestinians. The Israelis are extremely apologetic. It's very painful to watch it. I can't tolerate watching it, because they can't refute them. You know why they can't refute them? Because they agree with them. Deep down, they don't have a Torah. They don't believe that they even have a right to be in the land. So they exist. They exist by virtue of the approval of the world. But now the world is saying that you're the Goliath. You're the oppressor. Occupation. That's a horrible word in the academic circles. To be an occupier. To be depriving people of their rights. And the Israelis really believe that they're doing it. In fact, they're actually educating the kids that way today. They're teaching them the new curriculum, which is based upon a whole revision as to the history. It's basically from the Arab point of view that we did take away, we did occupy, we did drive them out. How do you expect a soldier to go out there and fight for the defense of the land when he himself is troubled, he has guilt that he doesn't belong there in the first place? But that's what they did. They were extremely successful in that. Now, I'll give you my own personal interpretation of how the peace process came into being. I don't think Israel will admit this, but the Arabs finally discovered the weapon that would work against Israel. There's this tremendous barrage of public opinion which softens them up. But the real, if you want to know the real cause, and this is my own historical analysis, for whatever it's worth, I majored in history in college. It's really not worth much, because if the analysis makes sense, then it's good. It's not enough. But in my opinion, it's something called the Intifada. The Arabs discovered a weapon that Israel could not fight against. And basically, they may have discovered it from a Jew. This is an interesting quiz. Who would you say, which book would be the one that a sharp Arab would get the idea from? Who wrote a book? If you read that book, you can understand all the concepts of the Intifada are found in that book. But it was written by a great Jew, one of the greatest patriots of the 20th century, one of my heroes, Menachem Begin. He wrote a book called The Revolt, explaining the underground revolt against the British. And guess who carried that book around with him in Lebanon when Israel invaded Lebanon with Sharon to try and smoke out the PLO? Yasser Arafat carried a copy of the book around with him. That was his Bible. He learned a heck of a lot from Menachem Begin. Begin's basic idea, you see, when you discover something new, your enemy could always use the same. His basic idea was, he knew that they couldn't defeat the British. The British was a powerful empire even after World War II. But they organized these attacks. And to make life unbearable and miserable. But what about, so why couldn't the British just squelch them? He said, we're living in a glass cage, so to speak. The eyes of the entire world are upon us. So British cannot afford to look like, after the Holocaust, they can't go in and start destroying and repressing and then killing out all the Jews. They're going to be very, very limited in what they can do. So we can have a certain type of an advantage. We can keep attacking them and making life miserable, making the price higher and higher and higher, and they really do have the power to just come in and wipe us out, but they can't do so because they're a civilized Western world in the eyes of the world, and I'm Palestine. This is after the Holocaust. That was the strategy, and it worked. Guess what? It's working for the Arabs, because they discovered the power of a rock and a kid throwing stones, and constantly, and they don't care if the kids are killed. It doesn't bother them. Then he's a martyr. So he says, then he goes to paradise. But the Israelis are now caught up in the very same thing. They have this dilemma. They have the power to go in there and wipe them out. I mean, they tried this in Syria, and there's some Arab group, or some Islamic group, to try to rebel against Assad. It's called Hama. He had a problem. You read the book From Beirut to Jerusalem by Thomas Friedman. They tried to do that. Didn't last very long. He went in and he wiped out about 20,000-25,000 people in one day. Guess what? No problem.
He bulldozed the town.
And the moderate King Hussein, he was the big target that all the Israelis loved. He had an uprising Black September. The PLO was threatening to take over his country. This is, I think, 1972. Yeah, he had no problem. He wiped them out. And they would swim across the Jordan River and surrender to the Israelis, who they knew would protect them. So the Israelis are now caught in this tremendous dilemma. They can't fight a war because their own moral principles that they believe in, their philosophy, prevents them from fighting this kind of a war. So now they're stuck. They can only use a certain amount of power. How much power? They have to apologize. We used rubber bullets. We didn't. It wasn't our fault. And it keeps getting worse and worse because the pressure of public opinion keeps getting greater and greater and greater. And they, as a result of that, they keep getting more apologetic and weaker and weaker. So the problem is never, ever going to go away. Now, once they, you see, who was really responsible? That was the first Arab victory, by the way. The first Arab military victory in history was the Intifada. They defeated the entire Israeli army. That's defeat. I don't care how the Israelis keep praying. We have the power. If we wanted to, we could do this. We'd show you. If you want to, you could, but you're not. You don't want to. You don't have the guts, and you can't do it. You don't have the moral courage. I'm not sort of saying it that way to be a bitch. I'm just being very descriptive. If you can't do it, you can't do it. It doesn't matter. Even Netanyahu, who's tougher than Barak, said, we haven't used an iota of the power that we really have. Barak keeps reminding how much power we really have if we ever going to use it. But well, who cares? We know you're not going to use it, so what difference does it make? You have nuclear weapons too. You couldn't use them over here. Now, Rabin was the architect of, he was the one who was in charge. He was the defense, defense minister. Defense minister of the Intifada, and he went out saying, we're going to break their bones, like it's the same old Israeli mentality, that they won't stand up. Guess what? They won. And guess what? When they saw that they couldn't defeat them, then they all of a sudden discovered that there's peace. Then they all these guys, Rabin, read their book, Perez, the architect of others, read a book called David Sling by Shimon Peres, which was written in the 70s, when he recognized the truth that the PLO is only out to wipe us out. We'll never negotiate with them because we can't, because they're out to destroy us. And the same, and Rabin, I read Rabin's biography, Abi Eban, who referred to the lines that they're now contemplating as the Auschwitz lines. Every one of Israel's doves was a hawk when he was able to see things clearly. Well, nothing changed. The Arabs haven't changed. What's changed? They've gone through a transformation and now they really want peace. They went into a state of self-delusion. And here's how I'll quote a pasuk for you. The pasuk does say what will happen to you, because the problems basically are going to be for your own. You're going to create your own problems. When you deviate from the way of God, you can act in a way which is, I said if you act intelligently, you still wouldn't succeed, but you're not. You can act foolishly. Because the Torah says that you will grope in the afternoon, like the blind man gropes in the darkness of night. So the rabbis ask the question, but what's for a blind man, what's the difference if it's night or if it's day? So one of the rabbis said, I didn't understand this until I was walking one night and there was a blind man and there was all kinds of pitch and he could have fallen in, but another individual came with a torch. And he came along, and he used the torch, and he held on to his hand, and he followed him. So now I understood what he was saying. Because there's two kinds of blindness. There's a case where it's blind, but there are other people that can see, and they can help you. But then the real tragedy is when you're blind, and everybody else around you is blind, and there's no way that you can have any kind of help. That's the problem that the Israelis have fallen into today. due to the inability to resolve this problem, they began to, they were seized by this illusion, the illusion of a peace process, which is based upon a fundamental mistake. And the mistake is basically that the Arabs are really no different than we are. And they too want peace. And it's just a question of reaching the proper arrangement with them. And once we're forthcoming and we make concessions, then they'll live in peace with us. It goes back to the same illusion, that ultimately we can live side by side with the Arabs. Now, in spite of everything, well, I thought you had that idea. But then you see that everything is false. That it's not true. They continue to teach the children hatred. The same as I said, if that's the case, show me the proof of a transformation. First make a transformation. First say that we're going to uproot anti-Semitism. We're going to instruct the children to accept the Israelis, just like the Israelis instruct their children, that no Israelis teach their children to hate Arabs. So everything remains the same. The suicide bombing increases. The terrorism increases. And it keeps, the more you give back, the worse it gets. Well, and the Israelis, the worse it gets, the more deluded they get. The more they just deny the reality. They can't accept the reality. They're smitten with blindness. They can't get out of this blindness that they're smitten with. Let me tell you the ultimate proof. The ultimate proof would be Barak. In a sense, I don't know if this is intention, but everybody says, well, as a result of Barak, we now see clearly. That was the first reaction. Because Barak basically was willing to give back everything. He said, I'll give 95% of the land. And even Jerusalem, which was, I used to argue with all my friends, I won't mention any names, though, some of my chaverim at the time, we used to have big arguments about land for peace. And until years ago, there was a legitimate position. And I would always say, knowing Rabbi Rosenthal, I say, okay, fine, you have to have a solution, and this and that, maybe it can work, all right. So, but I say one thing, knowing where his heart is at, I say, well, what about when it comes to Yerushalayim? Remember, what's, no, chas v'shalom, that never will be, can't get. I said, but I understand, why not? Because once you've established the principle that you're willing to give back land for peace, so why is this piece of land any different than any other piece of land? In your mind, you looked up to Yerushalayim, but they don't, why do they care? What logical reason is there to stop at Yerushalayim? But everybody said, no, that can't be, or let it be. I mean, we're not going to give that back. They're not that crazy. Oh, no. Oh, no. Now that's the whole thing. Because after Barak gave him back everything. Now, this is the ultimate proof. Because if it's true, according to the other hypothesis, if this is really about an accommodation, so then you're saying that basically there's no real underlying hostility over there. It's basically because they need a land. They want a land of their own. It's for about the West Bank. Never mind that there was never a Palestinian state. There was never an Arab state in the West Bank. Never mind that when they had the West Bank, when Jordan was in control, there was no Palestinian liberation movement to create a state in the West Bank. Never mind that all the nations attacked Israel when they had all the territories that they're seemingly fighting about all now. Which alone should tell you right off the bat that that can't be the cause. But if that's the case, if it's a business, then it's a business thing. If we have an argument over land, any kind of an argument over land, people can be locked up in a dispute. Divorce battles can go on for years. And so it's about, let's say it's about the money. So people can get stubborn. Yeah, but then finally, when it's, you reach a reasonable amount, you say, oh, that's it, we're in the ballpark already. That's it. I got, if that was what it was about, when it's 95%, and he's making concessions, and Clinton is saying that Barack made all the concessions. So Clinton is the one that's arranging it. So he's saying, according to my understanding of it, you should sign. Why aren't you signing it? This is what, So Clinton, of course, is neutral. I mean, you're not going to say that he's pro-Israel. He's not saying that to bolster Israel. That means to say that, according to my understanding of the situation, he made very, very reasonable concessions. That should end it. The problem's over. Then he goes and he unleashes the worst violence of all. Now, what are they fighting? What is it? And then he's openly been saying it's about an intifada. It's about Jerusalem. He's always been telling the Arabs that. And he goes back and they allowed everything in Oslo to be violated, and the Israelis now find themselves in a crazy situation where they're fighting against an enemy that they created themselves. Who armed the Palestinians? Who gave them the weapons? Who gave them militias? Who gave them guns? Who collects money for them right now to this day, is giving them billions of dollars a year? They create their own enemies. They release terrorists. Now, do they really want peace? How is it possible to maintain? That is a classical case. That is a class law case of a projection. See, the Jews want peace. And the Jews assume that everybody wants peace. But that's just not true. The Arabs never had any value. They don't value peace, and they don't want peace. They want conquest. Why else would they glorify a suicide bomber? He's the greatest hero in the Arab world. We don't glorify that kind of a thing. It all comes down to, and it's amazing that even now, after Barak has said many times in the moments when he couldn't deny it that there is no peace partner, so he has a moment of insight and awakening, but he can't pull out of it. He can't pull out of it because he's smitten with a certain blindness. See, that's the problem. That's the arrogance. That once a person commits himself, that's why I maintain that there's no way out of the present morass unless you get a new government. Unless Barak resigns. He's under the control, to a tremendous extent, of Clinton. I just read yesterday or today that he wanted to bring in Sharon, which would make sense, but Clinton got on the phone with him and pressured him not to. So he's beholden, basically, to Clinton. But he can't free himself from this illusion. I just want to read you one more thing. I'm going to be concluding. I know the hour is late. But you just bear with me. It's not an easy subject to cover all of the ground that I wanted to cover. I just have one thing I wanted to read from. Here it is. This was an article by this, you can get it off the net, Rod Dreher, I guess you, Dreher. And he's saying, it's an example of televangelism. You know, I always wondered that when you read about these riots that they got, it's usually after the Arabs left the mosque and then they start throwing stones. So I was wondering, like, when Jews leave shul, they don't go out and beat people up. You know, it's not, whatever it is, it's not the message that you're being fed in shul. So why is it when they come out of the mosque that they start throwing rocks? So he's saying that this is what they're being told in the mosques. These little, quote, oh brother believers, the criminals, the terrorists are the Jews. They're the ones who must be butchered and killed, as Allah the Almighty said, fight them. Allah will torture them at your hands. The preacher, Sheikh Ahmad Abu Talabiya, former acting rector of the Islamic University of Gaza, was just getting started. Quote, oh you who believe, do not take the Jews and the Christians as allies, for they are allies of one another. Who from among you takes them as allies will indeed be one of them, the Sheikh continued. And if you are a Jew, or like unto them, quote, have no mercy on the Jews, no matter where they are in any country, he wailed. Wherever you are, kill those Jews, and those Americans who are like them, and those who stand by them. I mean, it's clearly, it's out in the open, that this is basically a Amalek. And the Jews, as long as they're operating with a false premise, and they refuse to see, they want to believe, that these people are essentially no different than us, in spite of all the evidence which is out there, and that by continuing to make these concessions, we can achieve the objective. It's exactly the opposite. They see your weakness, they see your retreats, they see you prepared to give away the Golan, they see the pullout from Lebanon, and that has emboldened them and encouraged them to press, to continue, because they know you guys want peace. We don't want peace. We're ready to die. You guys aren't ready to die. You want peace. That makes you extremely weak. In conclusion, I just want to say one thing. And that is to say that the Torah, when the Torah says that God will protect us and God will vanquish our enemies, it's not a magical thing. The Torah explains a little bit as to how God works. And the most important element that it mentions is the element of fear. And that is to say that strength is not to be found in weaponry, but that the Torah makes it very clear that God v'hamam v'humad gadola, that God will place the fear of you in their hearts, and that's what it says about the kriyas yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea, that nomogu kol yoshvei Kanaan, that the entire world was filled with fear and with trembling, and that's the crucial element. That's why the Torah commands when you go into war not to have fear, to have total faith. Nothing can possibly happen to you because God is with you. And when you don't have fear, then you act in a certain kind of a way, and then I don't know how God will bring it about, okay? But the pasuk says that the nation will see Kishem Hashem Nikla Lecha, that the name of God is associated with you, V'yaru Mecha. So that's why it says that one of you will chase hundreds, and 10 of you will chase thousands. And you saw that happening in the Six-Day War, when a couple of Israelis would capture hundreds or even thousands of Egyptians. The tremendous element of fear, that switched completely. That switched completely. That the Arabs had fear, and when they had fear, the Jews were able to control them. And now the complete reversal. The fact is the Arabs have lost their fear completely, and it's the Israelis who are cowering in fear. That is, all these are the signs of a tremendous type of a problem. So in conclusion, what I'm saying is that the only way that the Jewish people can see itself through on an ultimate level is to return to the true principles of Torah. Because it's only from the true principles of Torah that the Jews will be able to feel a conviction and a sense of confidence that this land belongs to them, and that they're fighting for a real purpose, and they will cease to be apologetic, and then they'll be able to take the kind of, I can't predict, I don't have a, you see, understand, it's not just the left wing. If the leaders were to come into power, they don't have a solution either. Bear that in mind. See, no party has a solution. So the reason why the Likud doesn't have a solution is because they agree with the basic underlying premises of the left. They're just more nationalistic and they're just more liberal. So you can't find it in politics. You're not going to find it in politics. But if you return to Torah, and that's the only way, and you achieve a certain type of a determination that the source of your strength is the fact that you're living in accordance with the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and He wants you to be there, and you don't feel guilty about it because you're there for the right purpose, then you'll acquire a tremendous kind of a strength. And then the power you have, the weaponry you have, the actions can be done. What specific actions that will come to the Chachamim? When you're a Chacham and you're acting with Chachma, the solutions will be found. But the real reason they'll succeed is because you'll have God with you. And when you have God with you, He'll place the fear and he'll drive them out. And just like they ran away in 67, they'll run away again. The entire thing is up to us. And therefore, we pray, we're mispalel, we have to support. And so practically speaking, we should not leave anybody to disparage, to abandon Israel. We have to support in every practical possible way. But the real support, the real help you give, is, as I said before, you want to help the Jewish people, you want to help mankind. You've got to do everything you can to direct yourself and to direct the rest of the Jewish people to be in line with their purpose, with the path that God wants them to live. If you do that, then you're helping, and every little action counts. So let's hope and let's pray, God willing, that we will once again experience a new Yeshua from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Mann. Rabbi, that your tefillah is lekuyam. Again, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Dr. and Mrs. Nemartin for hosting the evening. Also, to you people who may have come in a bit late, just want you to know that this was sponsored by the Torah Academy of Suffolk County, and is very, very happy and grateful to Rabbi Mann to have been able to present to you a presentation of such gravitas and meaning, significance, and tremendous food for thought. Talking about food for thought, refreshments are available, and also we'd like to have a million following, I guess.
We could dive right now,
Okay.
We should dive right now because people don't want to go.
Right.
Okay. Rabbi Rosenthal is saying, Kaddish, so if anybody didn't dive in, you can't, we can make a million.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you very much.